The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A look at the numbers shows clearly why, when people talk about heroin in New Hampshire, they use words like epidemic and crisis. 325 Granite Staters died from overdosing on heroin and other drugs last year, by far the most ever. And at the community level, the impact is equally staggering. Nashua, for example, is seeing drug overdose deaths this year at a rate nearly four times greater than last year's record numbers. And in Laconia, police say the drug situation has become so alarming, they've switched their focus from arresting addicts to helping them find treatment. Meanwhile, at the State House, funding debates over this issue continue, including whether Medicaid coverage should include substance abuse services. Adding this benefit could be expensive, and the state has many competing needs. But this year, new voices are arguing in favor of more state aid, a burgeoning recovery movement where former addicts are coming out of church basements and into legislative hearing rooms to share their stories. Today in The Exchange, rising fear and rising attention to heroin and other substances, including now fentanyl. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests with us for the hour. Cheryl Wilkie is here, Senior Vice President of the Farnham Center, a drug and alcohol treatment center in Manchester. Cheryl, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Eric Adams, Prevention Enforcement Treatment Officer for the Laconia Police Department. He's also worked as a corrections officer, patrol officer, and undercover narcotics officer. And Eric, good to see you. Thank you for making time out.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, John Eldridge, co-founder of Bonfire Recovery Services, a facility for men in Dover that requires abstinence from drugs and alcohol for its residents and promotes 12-step recovery principles. And John, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Sandy Coyle, regional coordinator for the Seacoast Public Health Network and Allies in Substance Abuse Prevention. She's a member of the Governor's Commission Recovery Task Force and has a seat on the board for Hope for New Hampshire Recovery. And Sandy, thank you also for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lots to go through, all of you. And I did want to start, though, big picture with you, Cheryl Wilkie. Why are these numbers of Granite Staters dying from drug overdoses, heroin and fentanyl we're hearing the most about, going up so much?
That question is multifold. There are so many different things that are taking place in the state. Heroin is such an addictive drug, Laura, that when we're talking about coming off of it, the medical needs of the patient, the client, to get through the detox is extremely important. Otherwise, they go right back to it because it's so painful. And we don't have a lot of medical detox in the state of New Hampshire, and the hospitals are not willing to do that either.
Medical detox means methadone, other drugs? What does that mean exactly?
Medical detox, we at Farnham Center have a 5 to 7 day medical detox where we give them different medications. Some are comfort meds like clonidine to help with the cramping of the legs, and Zofran for nausea. And we also use Suboxone, which is an opioid antagonist. And we use that to slowly take them off the drug versus having them go cold turkey where they become very ill. And if you watch somebody go through that, you understand why they walk out the door and go back to using heroin.
Yeah, so one reason, Cheryl, is that it's so hard to get off of these drugs. But why are so many people getting on them in the first place?
Well, heroin is very inexpensive. most people start using pills, prescription drugs. I've had many stories where people have used pain medications for back injuries, people that you would never think have never used drugs or alcohol in their lives. And then they start using pain medications. The doctor stops giving it to them. Heroin is very inexpensive, and they're on a run.
John, that's partly your story, isn't it?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Absolutely. As I was listening to that, I was thinking, you know, my experience was exactly that. I ended up in some doctor's offices because I had a bad back and a deteriorated disc. And, you know, they put me on some pain medication, as they should have. And I don't ever blame the doctors. I think there were some things that they did overlook. But, you know, after a while, I was so hooked on dependent on these medications, and then slowly, you know, was cut off and, you know, turned to heroin because it was cheaper. It was easier to get. It was affordable. It was available, accessible. And that kind of started my path down heroin addiction.
And what was it that they overlooked?
I think a lot of the signs that were showing up were, you know, they were increasing the dose over time. They have to, because as you become adjusted to the medication, they have to increase the dose. I was on it for a really long time before they kind of looked at it and said, hey, like, maybe we should think about something else. But also, you know, they started prescribing me. It started off as Percocets, and then it went to oxycodone, and as we know, the OxyContin, and then it was higher doses of the OxyContin, and eventually, you know, the big buzz out there now is the fentanyl, and I was prescribed fentanyl.
So it's legal, fentanyl.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, by prescription, it's a scheduled narcotic, and it's, you know, it's used for extreme cases and chronic pain. And that's what I had. But I was also 20 years old, you know, so I think that's something that gets overlooked. And I did end up having a surgery. The surgery was successful. And eventually that's when I came out. They took me off the medication because they could see that I wasn't doing okay. You know, I'm 20 years old. I'm probably 40, 60 pounds underweight. Just not doing well. And you know, like I said, I'm not even 21 years old yet.
So, and again, you said, you know, I'm not blaming anybody for this. I do wonder, though, John, from what I understand, you know, you had used drugs before. I mean, it seems like maybe the prescribers should have been a little bit more aware of your past drug use at a very young age and said, you know, this guy's not a good candidate for fentanyl.
Yeah, and I think those are some things that got overlooked. And I have family history, and, you know, so proper assessment could have probably guided them to make different decisions in my care. You know, the other side of that is I was dishonest. I liked the medication. So I wasn't entirely honest with them through the whole process either. And that's where I don't blame them. They had a part in it, but particularly, especially in my recovery, I have to take responsibility for that. So I don't necessarily blame them, but they definitely did have a huge part in it.
Well, and we have heard so many stories like this where people, often it's a back injury and it's really painful and they are prescribed pretty powerful painkillers and then get addicted to heroin and other drugs. Your story, Sandy, from what I understand, is different. Tell us a little bit about how you started using heroin.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to the complexity of this issue and the many things that do contribute to it. And I think another side of it is that when we look at alcohol and other drug use as a whole, you know, New Hampshire ranks pretty high. And so besides, you know, in addition to people having this, you know, faster path to what they may not have already been predisposed to and getting prescribed and then finding themselves in this escalating addiction, we also have a youth population that are using alcohol and other drugs at a higher rate than other youth across
yeah,
the country.
Yeah, I've seen those numbers. We do have higher rates of substance abuse among our teens. Go ahead.
So that's, you know, and that really kind of speaks to my story where, you know, my use and addiction did start with drinking at age 13 and kind of escalated onto this path. And before I knew it, I was 19 years old. We had graduated from high school, and it was a pretty fun and exciting summer. And some people showed up to the party with heroin and not even knowing what it was. We tried it and then realized within really short time, I was driving down to the city and purchasing heroin to, to feed the addiction.
How short a time?
Really short, within a month.
Wow, you got addicted that quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, maybe marijuana where you try it, you say, eh, don't like it or whatever. You're addicted.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
How common a story do you think this is? I mean, again, we've heard stories like John's where it kind of starts with the opiates. But what about stories like yours where you're just kind of your average teenager and then all of a sudden you're driving down to, you know, Philadelphia or wherever looking for heroin?
We're hearing it a lot. And I think when you look at the age range of people that are losing their lives right now, it's a young, you know, a lot of it is a young adult population. And you see pictures of young, beautiful faces, you know, men and young women who are losing their lives. And when you hear the stories from their parents or neighbors or teachers, these are good kids. And I don't think, you know, it's not that the old kind of perception or misperception that it only happens to those people. This is really happening to our friends, neighbors, and our children.
Well, and Eric Adams, you're out there working with addicts on the streets in Laconia. What are you seeing? What's the demographic?
So basically, what we're seeing is people in our community that, you know, you wouldn't normally think that would be associated with this. And that's the stigma, I think, that we try to overcome, is that it affects anybody and everybody. And, you know, in our community, you know, it's a small community. And so we were seeing such an uptake in it that we needed to come up with a new way, an innovative way that we can work with the people that are suffering, instead of just locking them up, because that's not breaking that cycle. All that's doing is just extending it. It's you know, it's delaying the inevitable. So for us, so far, you know, it's only been in effect now for the last like 7 months, and it seems to be working really well.
Wow. So Laconia decided we can't arrest our way out of this problem. It's too big.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what I'm seeing, you know, throughout the state, I think a lot of agencies are starting to really come to that realization that it's time to look at it in a different light. So, you know, with us, you know, I go to overdoses. I work with either the individual that overdoses or the individuals that, you know, their families as well. You know, we try to come up with solutions.
All right. And I'll ask you definitely a lot more about those solutions and everybody else, too, after a short break. You can join us as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at the fight against heroin in New Hampshire and now new concerns about fentanyl mixed in with that battle. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're looking at why the numbers of drug overdose deaths is going up so much here in the Granite State and some of the reaction and efforts against that. 1-800-892-6477. We're hearing stories from people who have personally struggled with this issue, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Eric Adams, again, your police officer in Laconia, you were talking about how your department decided we can't arrest our way out of this. You're trying a new approach. Go ahead. I want to let you finish up there.
Yeah. So we're trying, you know, we started back in October of 2014 with this new approach. So basically, we have an officer that is dedicated specifically to working with individuals in our community that are suffering from substance misuse. And, you know, when you're the thought on this is when you're on patrol, you don't have that opportunity to take that extra time with the individual to actually listen to them and actually hear what they're saying. So we as an agency decided that with what we want to do is we want to try to engage with the individual more and the individual's family. And our idea is like this wraparound where, you know, we kind of hit it from all different angles, you know, treatment, recovery, support. So, you know, it's been a good road so far. I think our community's been really receptive to it. And just to take you a little bit to what I do, so we go to, you know, if I go to an overdose, I will then, you know, I will sit down with the individual and or the family or the other person that might have been have seen the overdose. And then what we do is we try to come up with, you know, you're hitting them at that most critical point. You know, they get that realization, I almost died.
Right.
So, you know, you want to just, you can't obviously force someone. So you have to really try to understand their story and find out why it is that they got to the point that they're at.
So you're really acting more like a social worker than a police officer.
Yeah.
You feel trained for this? Do you feel up for it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I do leave, you know, that's the other part. I don't claim to be, you know, a social worker. I will guide that person to a resource, and or several resources. And then it's up to them to make that decision as to whether or not they're going to accept it.
Well, and I definitely want to ask everybody about resources, treatment, and so forth. But very quickly, to clarify, Cheryl Wilkie, NHPR's digital reporter Brian Walston has a piece on our website today about heroin and fentanyl. So this has come up a little bit with John, your story. But just for people who haven't heard of fentanyl, what is it and what's the connection between fentanyl and heroin?
Fentanyl is another narcotic. It's a very powerful pain reliever that is being used just like heroin, just like OxyContin. It's easy to get when you have, you know, certain disorders that would call for that type of pain relief. And anytime you can get a doctor to prescribe a medication, they're going to get them to prescribe it. I think when John was talking about how he told them, you know, different stories, usually they'll say it hurts even with the OxyContin. It hurts with five, so we need to go to fentanyl. We need to go. The doctors, you know, they take a Hippocratic oath to make sure that you're not in pain. And it's a really tough balance for them because that's what they're trying to do, and yet they also know that this is a horrible addiction. There's been a lot of doctors that I've worked with lately that are having licensed alcohol drug counselors on staff, regular pain management doctors, to be able to do the assessing as they come in every week. And I found that that protocol is really helpful.
So those are folks who are deeply trained in prescribing and so forth and can maybe say to the doctor, you know, a couple red flags there.
Yes. But I love when Eric talks about, you know, being a social worker, that he's, you know, not a social worker, he's a police officer. But, you know, it doesn't take a professional to show love and compassion. And really, that's all they're looking for is love and compassion and somebody to say, let me take you this way. Let me show you this way. And we can all do that. It doesn't take a professional to help somebody get there.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. So Eric talked about, you know, at that vulnerable moment, helping someone say, yeah, I need to get into treatment. But how easy is that, Sandy Coyle? I mean, if someone is in a terrible situation and they say, yep, I want to turn it around right here, thank you very much, how easy is it for them to do that?
It's challenging. That's definitely not an understatement. New Hampshire, as you know, we rank second to last in our ability to provide treatment for those seeking. We do have treatment that's working in our state and that's effective, but it's not enough. And I had a firsthand experience after my story became more public in the Seacoast area where people were picking up the phone and asking me and telling me I need help. And I navigated the treatment intake system with a few people. And it's hard. And for someone who is kind of at their weakest moments and desperate. And
you've kind of hit rock bottom. Right. And then you're supposed to figure this out.
Right. And to really push through those phone calls and the intake process can be challenging. So, it's a need for sure.
How do you approach this, John? Your organization, Bonfire Recovery Services, it's new. It's got kind of a fresh approach on this.
Yeah, just about a little over a year that we've been open. I think always, especially in our state, we have just a lack of available beds for service. So I think it's always going to be a challenge to try. A lot of times people call looking for resources and, it's hard to connect someone. It depends on if they have insurance. Even if they do have insurance, are we going to be able to find a spot? Is there going to be a 6-week waiting period? Because that window of opportunity, unfortunately, is really, really small. And if somebody's reaching out for help, they need help immediately. And if we can't get them in somewhere, chances are we're going to lose them, and who knows if they'll pop up again.
Why is that window so small?
I think it's just part of the nature of substance use disorders, the psychological part that comes along with it, obviously the physical part that comes along with withdrawals. If somebody's in withdrawals, they have that moment of clarity, like, I got to do something. But then 5 minutes later, it's like, yeah, I'll do that later because right now I'm sick and I need my fix. Mm. Or the psychological part comes in and the dishonesty starts to formulate about, maybe I was making too big of a deal of that. Maybe this time it'll be okay. And then, that proceeds going back out.
Let's take some calls, and then I have questions for you folks as well on that. But on that short window and what happens when that window closes, let's go to our callers, though, as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And Brian joins us first from Alexandria. Hi, Brian. You're on the exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me. And I first of all, I want to say thank you for taking on this topic. It's
sure.
such an important one. I just want to share my experiences. I had a son that 5 years ago passed away from an overdose on pills, and it's very similar to one of your guests who had a back injury. His situation was very, very much the same. One of the things that happened with him was he was able to get free of the of the Percocets and whatnot that he was had been taking, prescribed by the doctors. He was doing relatively okay for a while, and then he wasn't on anything, and he had done some things that caused him to have a relapse of back issues, and he went back on them, and he went back on a dose that he had gone off of, and it took his life.
Oh.
My wife and I have started an organization here in the Newfound area called Stand Up Newfound, very similar to what's going on in Laconia. By the way, that was Stand Up Laconia. I'm sure that some of you guests have heard of that. And we're just trying to bring awareness of to the situation, because quite frankly, it is affecting a very large portion of our society, and like you said earlier, the people that are being affected are people that are not necessarily the people you expect, and so we're trying to bring awareness to that, and I just want to say thank you to all of your guests who are raising awareness to this issue and trying to help.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for calling. I'm so sorry to hear about your son. It's terrible what happened to you, and I really appreciate you calling in. It's a tough story to tell, and I did want to ask about what he mentions, and I'll turn to you first, I think, Cheryl. It does seem like more and more we are hearing people who have struggled personally with this issue, like Sandy, like John, family members like Brian, who's called in. These folks have also testified before the legislature. As somebody who's worked in this field for a long time, what's your take on this sort of more openness about this subject today? People are willing to say, yeah, this was me, or this was my son.
I'm ecstatic about it. I'm very, you know, I am in recovery. I've been in recovery for 27 years, and I'm also a psychologist with a LADAC and all these degrees. And when I first got into the field, you didn't say that you were in recovery. It just, if you said that, it really could hurt your credibility. And to watch people now that I'm training or interning who are in recovery going to the state house and speaking, it's amazing to see the change. I love that people are speaking out. I just wanted to say that with the recovery movement happening, it's an amazing thing what people are trying to do. I know Sandy's trying to open a recovery center. We need these places for people to be able to spend time. But one of the things that the state has not been willing to look at or address is that there's no beds because we have no money. You know, we have no taxes. We have no gambling. We have all these things that we don't want to do, and yet we're burying our children. And we have got to start looking at what can we do to make sure that we don't have to hear these stories anymore. And it may be changing New Hampshire a little bit, but it's going to change. And I think we need to figure out how we want it to change versus letting it happen, whether it be with taxes or gambling, because treatment beds are very difficult to fund. And just so everyone knows, at the Farnham Center, between 8 and 10 in the morning, anyone can walk in and get assessed. You don't have to call. You don't have to call after you get assessed. If you get a bed, you get a bed. If you don't get a bed, you can be seen daily until you get a bed. So there's always going to be something that we can do for you while we're trying to get you in, because if we don't have a bed, we don't have a bed, but we are trying to build capacity in the state.
Well, Cheryl, people often talk about, you know, the state doesn't have enough resources to do this. What about private insurance, though? I mean, you know, is this all the state's responsibility? If this is a public health issue, shouldn't private insurers be, you know, kicking in here?
Well, you know what? They are. And that's why we're able to continue to build capacity. Anthem, Cigna, they all have benefits as well, and we are able to bill them. And I think we're getting better as a treatment movement of how to bill, because it was all the state. And I think the reason Farnham has been successful, I know the reason, is that we have a payer mix now, that we're not depending on the state and that we are looking at insurance companies. But it still leaves a population of people without money, without insurance, even though managed care is there, that still is going to need some support, whether it be on the treatment end or when they leave, whether it be to help build a recovery center. These are things that you can't build for a recovery center. You know, I'm trying to help bring awareness to it. These are things that we need as a state.
So a couple questions based on what you said, Cheryl. Eric, first of all, so what do you do if you come across someone in that overdose situation, in that crisis situation? They say, yes, I want to change, and you can't find a bed, or they don't have the capacity to pay for it. What do you do with that person?
So that's where the support comes in. That is where you take that extra time to spend with them. The way our program runs is I have a specific phone, and I give that phone number to them, and my number is 24/7. They call me whenever they want to talk. You know, I've found that I've gotten calls, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and you know, it's at that crisis moment where they're I need it now. And by the end of our conversation, we're talking about the Red Sox. We're talking about, you know, other things that, you know, so, and it sometimes it takes an hour, sometimes it takes, you know, 2 hours. But I think checking on that person, you know, just kind of spending that extra time with them, you know, they're people, and this is a disease. And, you know, this is something where they need that help, you know.
Sandy, what's the difference between treatment and recovery? Because to the uninitiated, it kind of sounds like the same thing.
Right. And I think what Eric's speaking to is the value of peer-to-peer support. And treatment is really that first point of kind of clinical-based care that someone can walk into and have that structure and that supportive environment around, you know, at a time with their early entry into recovery. In my opinion, that's the start of a recovery journey, you know, and treatment is just that structured, sometimes medical care that people need. But a lot of people do find recovery, and really that's your first step into attempting to get clean and sober from alcohol and other drugs. And what has worked so well with the, you know, kind of the 12-step model is the peer-to-peer support.
People who've been through it.
Right. And that's where a lot of the recovery center models are kind of working from. And as people in recovery become more vocal with their stories, is that hand, that reaching out, that people do recover from this. There is hope available, and people are here to walk you through that. So sometimes if treatment's not available, we can hook people to the ancillary supports, whether it's counseling, mental health, behavioral health, some medical attention, and still walk them through a pathway to recovery.
So, John, at Bonfire Recovery Services, are you sort of doing both treatment and recovery?
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, we don't offer any clinical services. We have some add-on services and you know, we usually set people up with services.
You can guide people.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing. We are going to add a clinical component shortly here. We do add some neurofeedback services, which is pretty interesting. But yeah, really, it is kind of like treatment. I mean, it is residential care. It is structured care. But it is also recovery. So it's more of like a recovery support service. I wouldn't necessarily call us treatment. But essentially it is treatment. You know, the guys are living there. The guys are engaged. We do have group activities.
Peer-to-peer
curfews. Yeah, peer-to-peer is hugely important. It's one of the most important factors of the structured sober living.
All right. Lots of calls and emails in just a moment. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at the heroin crisis and the number of drug overdose deaths that reached 325 last year, far more than ever. We're looking at the impact and the new voices of recovery that are adding into this discussion. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. And Paul's calling from Nashua. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi there. Recently out of recovery, and I'd like to thank the gentleman for having his 24/7 out there for those in danger. There's something I'm not sure that you'd like to talk about is after treatment, it's probably 30% that actually stay with the recovery, which the recovery I had was great, and I don't understand that number.
Did you do a 12-step, Paul, or did you have a medical intervention or some other kind of treatment?
I had a 30-day treatment program for OxyContin. I was on opiates for about 10 years.
Wow.
Actually 20, but I had a big problem with going through the withdrawal.
Sure, which people have talked about. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and there's all kinds of side effects that continue to happen. But, yeah, as far as treatment goes, yeah, you can get that, but recovery is mostly on your own.
You have to
follow what was given to you. And if you give up on that, then you're probably going to relapse, as they say.
Well, could we talk about this a little bit? Do you want to jump in first, Sandy, and maybe you, John? This is an important point. And actually, you started out talking about this, Cheryl, when I asked you why these numbers are so big. You said because it's so hard for people to get off. But go ahead, Sandy.
That's a big reason why I've been working with Hope for New Hampshire Recovery. And New Hampshire is the only state in New England that hasn't made available community-based recovery centers. And our effort in the Seacoast has been with a group of people in recovery that have emerged and are supporting Safe Harbor Recovery Center, which would be a place in the community. Because when, you know, people go off to 28-day programs or are participating in intensive outpatients or services or may not have access to treatment, you know, the communities that they're living in or coming back into are part of the same problem that was contributing to the addiction. And so we want to look at helping communities be a more resilient and healthy place for people to come back into and be supported in their recovery. And
that's tough. So if you go back to the same social scene that got you into trouble in the first place, chances are good you'll relapse.
Right. And really emphasizing we've looked at the barriers that people have in maintaining long-term successful recovery, and we've incorporated that into the community recovery center model. And so it's the peer services with telephone support service, having that person available to call you and check in and see how your day is going. We have recovery coaching that would be available, and all pathways to recover, all recovery meetings. So whether you're a family member or you've experienced addiction with heroin or alcohol or marijuana, there's a seat at that table for you.
John, did you want to jump in on this issue too?
Yeah, I think it's important.
It doesn't always work, he's saying.
Well,
caller.
Yeah, and I think that depends on the continuum of care that's provided. So one of the big problems is that the acute model, you know, a 28-day treatment facility, it doesn't mean that it didn't work for someone. But if, like we just said, if we're dumped back into a community or a family or an environment that's not conducive to recovery, there's a higher chance of relapse. So, and that's why, you know, Bonfire Recovery Services is the way that we are. We primarily take people that have already done a 28-day treatment, or they've at least done a detox, some sort of primary treatment, and then come to us for the extended care. You know, so they're there for a minimum of 4 months, up to a year, because we know that the longer someone's engaged in treatment, the better the outcomes. And so it's not that treatment failed someone. It's just that there was nothing set up afterwards.
That's so interesting. So that gets to what we just talked about a minute ago, the difference between treatment and recovery. So you guys are really helping folks after treatment not get back into that same bad situation.
Absolutely, yeah. And just to continue on that care, you know. And I mean, if you think about it too, like this is where treatment is where recovery starts, but it's not recovery. It's there are some psychological and medical components that are dealt with in the initial phase of treatment. However, you know, out of the 28 days, some of these people, including myself, are actually detoxing for almost 22 of them, you know.
Wow.
So how much recovery has really started? Maybe you get that last week, you know, of your brain clearing up. You know,
saying, oh, this is good.
Yeah, it's like being in therapy. I mean, you can't expect to make huge progress in 28 days of, you know, meeting once a week with someone. It's an ongoing thing, especially if first 3 weeks you're not even present to it. You know,
you're just kind of there.
So that's, but that is necessary, because a lot of people, when the physical component is on them, they need to be separated. And this, including myself, I need to be separated from it, because if it says go, I'm going. And if I don't have walls around me and people around me, I'm gone.
Thank you so much for the call, Paul. And as we talk about treatment, recovery, here's an email that came in earlier from Christine. She says, my 34-year-old son is a heroin addict. After he was stabbed brutally, the doctors put him on Vicodin. When they took him off these pills, his addictive personality led him to heroin. Pain pills for too many things, she says. He's been through rehab twice where he lives. His family and friends know about Narcan. The problem now is he lives alone and no one may find him. Christine says, my problem is this. The rehab programs get addicts off heroin and onto daily methadone, given at clinics where they do drug testing and help them find jobs. She says, however, my son still sounds stoned on methadone. She says it keeps the addicts high enough that they don't go out and commit crimes. However, it is far from a good cure. What do you think about this, Cheryl? We haven't really talked that much about methadone.
Well, Methadone is an interesting drug, and I can't say I'm a big fan. I'll be honest with you, Laura. I was when it first came to the state because, you know, we've been dealing with this addiction to heroin for over 10, 15, almost 12 years now that people have started dying regularly. So I was pretty excited when it came to New Hampshire, and I helped actually to bring it to the public because I was looking for any solution to people dying. But what I found out from my clients is that they could do the same thing they were doing with doctors, asking for more of the dose, and then they were on 300 milligrams and nodding out, and I became less of a fan. I really like Suboxone. It's another drug where we've been using it since 2010, and it has an antagonist to it. So it has naltrexone, which attaches to the neurotransmitters and will not allow the other opiates to continue to get you high if you continue to use. You can take so much Suboxone and it's kind of over. There's no buzz to it. It's a good medication. We've had great success with people on it. You wouldn't know if somebody was on it.
Does it reduce the craving for heroin?
It does have an opiate in it. It's opiates and naltrexone, so the craving isn't there, the nausea, all of that. Some people stay on it 2-3 months. Others are on it for 2-3 years.
How commonly used is this?
Very much so at this point. I think because of the overdoses and the deaths that people are just looking for any solution to that. And we're seeing clinics pop up all over the place.
By the way, I mentioned earlier the great reporting that NHPR's digital reporter Brian Walston has done on fentanyl and the role that it's playing in this. Brian sends us this clarification. He says, in most cases, the fentanyl that's being sold as heroin or mixed with it is not what doctors prescribe. That fentanyl comes in patches or lozenges. Brian says the stuff mixed in with heroin is powdered and made in illicit labs. This is what the state medical examiner told me. He said that law enforcement is not finding patches at the scene of overdoses. Brian, thanks for sending in that clarification. And again, Brian's report is on our website, nhpr.org. Did you want to jump in there, Eric? Fentanyl.
Yeah, definitely that's correct. You know, what they're seeing is the powder form. And it's, you know, coming, it's being manufactured in the illicit labs.
Super powerful.
Yeah.
From what I understand.
Super powerful.
Scary powerful.
Yeah. You know, it's anywhere from 15 to up to 100 times more potent than the opiate. So it's deadly for people that don't have an opiate tolerance. It will kill them. There's no question about it at some point because it's that powerful. You know, and I think what I was told as far as when Narcan is administered is that with when we've been seeing the overdoses we've been having, if a person is administered Narcan, and then they don't quite come out of it just yet, and they have to give them another dose and then possibly another dose, that shows a strong relation to fentanyl because it is so much more powerful.
So that gives you a clue that that's what's been used here.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for that again, Brian. And let's go back to our phone callers, and Robert's waiting in Goffstown. Hi, Robert. You're on the exchange. Go ahead. Robert, are you with us? Okay, looks like Robert got distracted there. Robert, hope you try and call back. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Tim's joining us from Campton. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. How are you today?
Fine.
I've been in recovery almost 30 years. I have a daughter that overdosed on heroin when she was 30 years old, passed away. I really applaud the Laconia police officer that's treating this as a health issue and the fact that they're doing that, because to me that's really what the issue here is. This is a health issue. If this was some kind of other epidemic, there'd be special hospitals opening up. There'd be all kinds of things going on to treat this. Portugal decriminalized all their drugs and have treated it as a health issue. And they did that several years ago, and their addiction rate is drastically reduced. The amount of money they were putting into enforcement, they've used to finance treatment centers, and the drug problem as they were experiencing it several years ago, which was epidemic, is drastically reduced by over 50%. One of the contributing factors to my daughter's death, she had a bad accident, got addicted to OxyContin from the pain medicine from the doctors had given her, and we ended up getting her. All we could find were these short three-day detox programs. We couldn't find any kind of long-term treatment facilities for her at the time. This is, mind you, this is almost 12 years ago. It was 2003 in August. And consequently, what happened is in one of these detox places, she met a guy that got her to try heroin as a painkiller, basically. And 2 weeks after she got out of that detox center, she overdosed on heroin and died.
Oh, Tim, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. You know, this is a young woman who was going to vet school. She had the world by the short hairs. I mean, she was really doing fantastic. And it was just the tragedy of this was not being able to get treatment for her, not being able to, you know, I went through a 12-step program. I'm a very strong-willed person, and I was able to, I had a very bad problem with alcohol, cocaine, and anything else I could get my hands on. And literally, I was, I got into some legal problems over it and everything. And, you know, for me, it was either straighten up or end up going to jail. And I'm strong-willed enough that with using AA and NA, having that support community of those two programs, it made the difference with me of staying straight and staying sober.
Yeah,
but what I just don't see is the government is pouring millions and billions into chasing the drugs and the drug dealers and all this other stuff, but the money needs to be going into treatment.
Well, and we're getting towards the end of the show, Tim, so I'm going to cut you off there, and I do apologize, and I'm so sorry to hear about your daughter. And you know, Cheryl, we heard earlier from someone who lost his son. I mean, this is our future, all these young people. Brian Gottlob, the economist, has done a study on this issue of just, you know, in addition to the terrible, terrible, terrible toll that this takes on individuals and families, this is costing the state money.
$1.8 billion is what he came up with when he did a research on what it was costing this in just employment and things that are happening. And we look at incarceration, $35,000 to incarcerate somebody. It doesn't cost that much for us to keep them in treatment or recovery centers. You know, the longer somebody stays in recovery, the better chances they have. And if we have all this money to be throwing at locking people up, and we're losing money with the employment issues that are taking place, we really need to focus our energies on what's the solution, not keep talking about the problem, because we know what the problem is. We listen to these stories every day, and they're so sad, and my heart goes out to every single one of these families. It's you listen to it over and over, and you just can't believe it continues. And I really hope that, you know, this program and others will start talking about what's the solution, because there is a solution. And it's right here. It's all of everybody out there who just cares enough about another human being to ask, can I help?
Wow. Well, again, Tim, and to Brian, who also lost a child. Again, a terrible thing, and I really appreciate you sharing your story. You know, we've talked so much about treatment, what that means, recovery, what that means. But, Eric, we haven't talked about maybe the most important piece, was just prevention, like encouraging people not to even start.
Yeah. Yeah, prevention is one of the main focuses, you know, that we really should start to pay attention to. You know, if the state would in turn focus, you know, on prevention methods, it would encourage, you know, the amount of usage that people are doing.
Yeah. Well, and again, as the mother of two, I'm very interested in prevention. Maybe we'll pick that up in a later show, Eric. Sandy, final thoughts from you.
Well, I just wanted to share that there is an opportunity this evening at the Palace Theater in Manchester at 6 p.m. The Anonymous People is going to be screened, and there will be people available to be talking about this issue.
All right. And all of you, thank you so much. I feel like we had so much more to talk about, but we really appreciate you coming in. Cheryl, it was good to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheryl Wilkie, Senior Vice President of the Farnham Center. That's a drug and alcohol treatment center in Manchester. John Eldridge, great to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
John Eldridge, co-founder of Bonfire Recovery Services, a facility for men in Dover. Sandy Coyle, good to have you. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Sandy Coyle, regional coordinator in the Seacoast Public Health Network and Allies in Substance Abuse Prevention. And Eric Adams, thank you also for your time.
Thank you.
Eric Adams, Prevention Enforcement Treatment Officer for the Laconia Police Department. This is The Exchange on NHPR.